We've all heard the expression, be careful what you wish for. I can't say for certain that thought passed through my mind during the extraordinary days and nights I spent on the grounds of the installation at Groom Lake. As is true of most experiences, when you are in the middle of one, deeply engrossed in the moment, you don't have a lot of time to consider anything but what is transpiring right then and right there. We've also all likely heard the importance of staying in the moment, staying present, and other variations on this idea. After having completed the last of the work on the pressure sensors, I arrived at Groom Lake a few days after speaking openly with Dennis. I went to the lab building as usual. What wasn't usual was that Dennis was there to greet me. At first, I didn't think much about him saying to me, "You're not going to be working inside today." Instead of going inside, we walked to the hangar facility. Barry joined us. I could see immediately that one of the hangar doors was open. With the light coming from it, the scene resembled a jagged jack-o'-lantern's mouth. I understood immediately that what Barry and I had been asking for was about to happen. This was the night we were going to see the actual craft, or crafts, themselves. My initial reaction was to feel enormously relieved. If they were allowing me this opportunity, then that boded well for my future with the team. I also felt vindicated. Barry and I had succeeded in convincing the powers that be that the best approach was a more open approach. Just how open that approach was going to be was still to be determined, but at least they'd acknowledged the importance of our input. In a work environment like the one we were subjected to, even the faintest of nods towards your needs seems like a monumental gesture. I was also thrilled by the opportunity to see such amazing technology up close. Even if what we'd said, that seeing the craft and the reactor, amplifier, and emitters in the craft could help speed the reverse engineering process, didn't prove true, the privilege of seeing something that presumably only a handful of humans had seen was going to be something I'd never forget. Along with all those thoughts came another. How much access to the craft were we really going to get? The answer to that question came rather quickly. Once the vehicle came to a stop and we dismounted, Dennis said, "Take a good look. I can't guarantee you'll get another opportunity like this one." I walked into the wedge of light coming out of the hangar and onto the concrete apron. I wanted to get the long view of the craft. The familiar saucer shape of the craft, like an inverted soup bowl resting atop a second one, sat on the paved floor of the hangar. It had no landing gear or other structure that might have supported its weight while on the ground. From what I could discern, it was approximately 50 feet or so in diameter and was roughly 20 feet tall. Where the two soup bowl discs met, the skin of the craft had a kind of rounded rim before the curves rose and fell to the narrower top and bottom. I moved closer and did a quick 360-degree turn around its perimeter, and where the two halves of the craft met, I could detect no seam. The same was true of the entire exterior of the vessel. I saw no panel lines, no welds, no rivets or other fasteners. As I had on first seeing the craft on that first day at S4, I ran my hand along the surface. I looked over my shoulder, half expecting to be reprimanded for touching it, as I had been previously, but none of the security team members said anything to me. As before, the skin of the craft felt like a metal, cool to the touch, and very, very smooth. It was dark aluminum in color, monochromatic across its entire surface, except for the four black rectangles near to the top of the upper dome-like portion. Later on, I would speculate that they were sensor arrays of some kind, planar sensors that assisted in some type of celestial navigation. But at this stage, I merely noted them and moved on. I was so engrossed in observing and noting as much as I could that I had nearly forgotten that Barry was also in the hangar with me. I entered the craft's interior through a small access hatch, just wide enough for me to put my shoulders through it with a fraction of an inch to spare. Once inside, I couldn't stand up straight. Work lights had been installed at various points inside the craft. I maneuvered on all fours, hunched and using my hands to steady me, but not kneeling, along a honeycombed access way. Just as the exterior of the craft appeared to be seamless and was all rounded surfaces, so was the interior. It also appeared to be made of the same material of the skin of the craft. I was struck by the idea that it was almost as if the craft had been fabricated from melted wax and then cooled into this shape. Injection molding was the closest terrestrial machining or manufacturing process that I could compare it to. On that lowest level, I saw three seats, similarly looking as if they had been part of the molding process and not manufactured separately and then affixed somehow to the rest of the structure. They reminded me of a Scandinavian chair without legs, looking very much like a rounded flower petal, more cupped than a tulip's, but nearly so. Just as the hangar had been lit so that we could see the craft's interior, so was the interior. The material only dimly reflected the lights, as if it had kind of a matte finish to it, but its color didn't appear to be layered on. Rather, it was integral to the material itself. Integral and integrated were the two words that kept springing to mind. Whoever had designed and built this craft seemed to have no concern for aesthetics, at least not human aesthetics. The three seats puzzled me. I saw no kinds of restraint systems, no indications of any life support systems, vents for example, and as I worked my way toward another access hatch, I was astounded by the fact that I saw not a single light, switch, dial, display, or anything that I associated with a vessel that traveled through space. All that interfered with the open design of this level, besides the seats, was a length of pipe coming down from the ceiling and exiting through the floor, presumably the parts of the propulsion system that carried the power or gravity wave from where it was generated to where it was emitted. I was in awe of the technology behind this elegantly simple and purposeful execution of a craft designed to travel enormous distances, and with what seemed to me to be based on the craft's construction, relative ease. It was on the second level that I saw the now very familiar elements of the propulsion system we'd had access to in the lab. The reactor sat on the floor. The waveguide piping ran from it to the amplifier, and then additional tubing ran down through the floor to where, I imagined, though I couldn't see them, the emitters sat on the bottom of the craft. That platform section, or what is probably better described as a pedestal, was what the craft rested on. How, or by whom, the craft was piloted and navigated was something that I was hoping to be able to see for myself, but neither Barry nor I were allowed onto the third level, where we presumed the pilot or pilots would have been positioned. I had hoped that I could have been able to sit inside what is traditionally termed the cockpit, but that wasn't going to be possible. Frequently, when I was faced with a design or some other kind of engineering or diagnosis and repair problem, I liked to sit with that problem. Often that meant walking away from the task at hand and just thinking about the issues or distracting myself with other work, hoping that on some subconscious level, I'd be able to come up with a solution. Other times, sitting with it took on a more literal sense. I would sit near the device, or in the case of my jet cars and other vehicles, like the ones I converted to run on hydrogen, I sit in the problem and, fully immersed in that environment, experience a kind of osmotic absorption of the solution to the problem. As cramped as the interior of that craft was, I imagined that the life forms who could move comfortably about in that space had to be the size of a 6 or 7 year old human, I wanted to linger inside for as long as possible. That possible wasn't too long, since cramped conditions literally can produce cramps. But I did take a few extra moments to marvel at the intelligence behind this execution and implementation of the propulsion system within the larger context of the craft itself. I was blown away by what I'd seen. I'd been convinced, for a while, that what we were working with at S4 was not of terrestrial origin. But seeing this entire craft really solidified what I'd come to believe. I knew with as high a degree of certainty that one can know anything that we didn't have the capability, the Russians didn't have the capability, the U.S. and the Russians working in concert didn't have the capability. All the world's greatest minds working together couldn't produce a working artifact like the one I was in. As I eased myself along to exit the craft, I kept shaking my head in wonder. My face had that half-flushed, half-swollen feeling of having smiled and laughed for too long. I briefly wished that I could share this experience with others. At the same time, my attitude had evolved in the time I'd been working at S4. Initially, though I understood the government's and military's position about secrecy, I resented it. Now that I was literally and figuratively on the inside of the operation, a kind of elitism set in. I didn't think that many members of the American public could truly appreciate the magnitude of the achievement this craft represented purely on a technical, scientific, and production standpoint. I was completely blown away, and I'd already been privy to a lot of information about the craft and its origins. Whether this craft came from Zeta Reticuli or was a product of the drunken or febrile imaginings of the collective membership of the Theta Tau engineering fraternity, it represented such an enormous advance in moving a life form from place to place that I struggled to come up with an analogy that would make sense to experience outside the craft. I disengaged the fawning fan mode in my brain and resumed scientific inquiry mode. I wondered about the craft's structural integrity, given that the skin of the craft seemed so thin. I wondered how heavy the vehicle was, but I couldn't really imagine myself putting my hands on it and trying to lift even a corner of that pedestal off the ground. I looked around the hangar and saw that a small crane stood in a far corner. I walked over to it and saw that its load limit listed on a safety sticker indicated a maximum capacity of 2 tons. That at least gave me a ballpark sense of the craft's mass. I thought of the fuel discs again and wondered for how many hours or light years they lasted, and if the ship's interior was mostly used as a cargo hold for them. How long had the one we had been using in our lab been discharging? Barry and I stood again on the apron in front of the open hangar door, and I wondered if our mouths were hanging open. We didn't speak until we were back in the lab. "Did you ever think you'd see anything like that?" Barry said. "Did anything in your life before this prepare you for that?" I've been trying to come up with a way to explain what this whole scenario is like, how to make sense of it for myself. The only thing I could come up with was this. Imagine that we were with the settlers on the Oregon Trail, riding along in our wagons back in the 1830s. We go to bed one night, and in the morning, we see this machine that has 2 wheels, a seat, handlebars, and some device cradled in its frame, and a chain going back to the rear wheel. We'd know it as a motorcycle today, but they'd only seen crude early bicycles. Given enough time, they'd probably be able to figure out how to get that motorcycle started and even to ride it a bit. They wouldn't understand how the engine worked, and even if they did, once the thing ran out of gas, it was probably only good to them as a plow they could drag behind draft animals. Barry nodded. "Something like that." "More to the point," I said, realizing that maybe Barry didn't feel the need for that kind of explanation. "I didn't see any signs of crash damage." "Listen," Barry said, "I was never a believer in the whole Roswell incident. I don't follow those kinds of stories. It seems strange to me that an intelligence that is advanced enough to produce what we just saw wouldn't be able to negotiate the Earth's atmosphere or have a landing system figured out or not be able to cope with our weather systems and phenomenon." "I agree," I said. "Just doesn't seem like a plausible explanation." Barry and I debriefed for a while longer, and we both postulated about how the propulsion system worked. We weren't any closer to figuring out how we could reproduce the devices to produce the kind of gravitational field we surmised was at work, but we had a better sense of how the reactor, the amplifier and the emitters worked to produce a kind of anti-gravity effect that would allow it to render our usual concepts of space and distance immaterial. Without realizing it, we were on the verge of doing something that I had only presumed was possible, witnessing the craft in actual operation. The next time I was called in to report, I still kind of chuckled at the insistent regularity of the message. "Hello, Mr. Lazar. It is now..." insert time. "We expect you to be at the installation at..." insert time. Barry and I got busy working with the modified pressure sensor instruments we'd devised. We were about to use them to measure the intensity of the gravitational field when Dennis stepped into the lab. "Follow me," he said. We went outside, and sitting in front of the open first hangar was the craft we'd recently examined. This time, and it struck me as odd, each of the interior doors connecting the individual bays was open. In addition to the craft that we'd been allowed to inspect, I could see 8 more saucer shapes through the procession of openings. I wondered briefly if we were going to be allowed to see all of them. Each of them looked to be of similar shape, and it wasn't just because of the distance I was from each of them, but they appeared to be of slightly different size. The one we'd inspected was smaller and sleeker than the others, as if it was the sports car in the lineup. In fact, from that point onward, I always thought of and referred to the craft I was able to enter as the sport model. "A low-performance test is going to be conducted. We thought the two of you should see this," Dennis said. I looked over at him, trying to see if he was pleased by his having made arrangements for this, but his face was impassive. I remembered the look of irritation on his face when I'd remarked that the military was still doing things then the way that they had nearly 50 years earlier out at Los Alamos and in Chicago and in other locations trying to create the atomic bomb. All that compartmentalization and secrecy had slowed progress. If they wanted us to be effective, they needed to let us share information. That was how most advances in science and technology, despite the belief in the romantic notion of the lone wolf working in isolation model, were made. Here we were getting some access, greater access to information than before, but still in a far more limited manner than I would have preferred. I knew it was time to keep my mouth shut and just observe, and that's what I did. What frustrated me was that with the exception of Dennis, Barry, and I, there were few other S4 personnel around. The omnipresent security guys were there on the periphery, but there was one technician sitting there with a pair of headphones on while seated in front of what must have been a radio, and one other man who stood at a distance from us and kept his back to us the entire time. I stood there with my arms folded, rocking back slightly on my heels, and then the craft did something similar. At first, I heard rather than saw any activity coming from the craft. A loud hiss, nothing painful, but the kind of buzzing sound that an electric substation might produce, reached my ears. Then, the craft lifted off the ground slightly, wobbling, the central axis tilting a few degrees from vertical. As it lifted off, I could see the blue glow of a corona discharge coming from the bottom of the craft. That led me to believe that the air around the bottom of the craft, where we suspected the emitter was being broken down and photons were being emitted. The light was visible, just as lightning in the sky is, due to that incredible high-energy output. As the craft rose, the slight oscillations lessened and the hiss diminished. By the time it was 30 to 40 feet in the air, lifting nearly perfectly straight up, the sound was completely gone. In all my years of working with jet engines and pyrotechnics, I was accustomed to hearing loud noises as objects were being propelled upward or forward. The silence was eerily exciting, and I felt a broad grin spreading across my face. I could hear the faint sound of an appreciative expulsion of air coming from Barry as I stood there wide-eyed and mind-boggled. I could see that the craft had 3 emitters. Only one was creating the corona display, and it was the one that was facing straight down at the ground. As the craft rose in the air, the display expanded. It began as a tight beam and became more diffused with each foot the craft rose. It was like watching someone twisting the lens of a flashlight, increasing the size of the circle of the light from its narrowest to its widest focal range. As that gravitational wave spread out, it helped to stabilize the craft. It hung there, completely still, as if it were suspended there by an invisible steel rod firmly anchored to the ground and some point above it. With it hanging there above us, we could see more clearly the bottom of the craft and its triad of emitters. They were arranged in a pattern, with the one that was hanging at the equilateral triangle. The other two emitters pointed at a right angle to the downward-pointing one. Given this orientation, because we were looking up at the larger spherical shape of the craft, I decided to think of the area to the left of the downward-pointing emitter as the rear and the area in front of the two other emitters as the front or forward section. That was because the opening of the two forward emitters pointed in that direction. And from what we believed of how the gravitational wave was produced, the energy coming out of the open end of the emitter would allow the craft to move in the same direction as the opening. I knew this was a low-performance test, but still, I was hoping to see the craft maneuver in the air. It didn't. I looked over at the technician with the radio. He was far enough away that I couldn't hear him speaking into a headset, but I could see that he was talking, presumably to whoever was piloting the craft. I thought again of the cramped space inside and the childlike proportions. I also wondered how in hell a radio wave, an electromagnetic wave, would be able to work in the presence of that gravitational wave. No kind of phase-locked loop should have been able to survive in that environment. The electronics guy in me engaged in a brief battle with the physicist in me over which phenomenal phenomenon to focus my attention on. I didn't have long to contemplate them. After a few minutes of hovering in place, the craft descended and settled, reversing the process of moving from a stable orientation to a wobbling one before coming to rest. "That's it," Dennis said, always the master of understatement. "Time for you guys to get back to work." Barry and I did as instructed, both of us lost in thought for the next 15 or so minutes. We each sat on a stool in front of the lab bench. Barry scrawled a few lines in a notebook while I fiddled with a micrometer, measuring the thickness of the lead points of a few pencils and comparing them to the lead rods I used in a mechanical pencil. It didn't seem odd for us to be so quiet. While engaged in work, we both tended to go inward. We'd both witnessed something on the order of a miracle, if one accepted the definition that a miracle was the result of an agency from outside our terrestrial realm, and we both needed time to process what we'd seen. I suppose in some Hollywood version of these incidents, the two of us would have charged into the lab flush with excitement and gone to the blackboard and started furiously writing and erasing parts of a complex equation we'd left there while exclaiming loudly, "I've got it! I can't believe I didn't see this before!" The truth was that since we'd started working, we had a sense of what was going on with the reactor, amplifier, and emitter. The flight demonstration simply confirmed that our theory was, for the most part, correct. We hadn't seen the craft move laterally, nor had it covered a great distance in a short amount of time, but the fact that the device created a focused beam, for lack of a better term, of highly concentrated energy and a gravitational field, that it could also disperse more widely, would allow it to cover vast distances. I had suspected that the gravitational field was doing something that scientists and science fiction writers had been speculating about for many years. It was producing a kind of negative gravity, or anti-gravity, that, in a sense, removed the gravitational force ahead of the direction in which the three emitters were pointing. In time, Barry and I came up with the name Omicron to describe the action of the single downward emitter functioning to lift the craft above the ground. That Omicron action allowed it to initially escape the gravitational pull of the very large body it was near, the Earth. When all three emitters worked, The same anti-gravitational force was produced, allowing the craft to move in multiple directions. This omnidirectional state of operation we termed Delta. We chose Omicron, the 15th letter of the Greek alphabet, because it means small. In the Omicron state, the craft and the propulsion system configured in this single emitter operation could only make relatively small moves. Delta, the fourth letter of the Greek alphabet, has its symbol used in science to indicate change. And we believed that when the three emitters were arranged in a kind of delta shape, as they were, it allowed the craft to essentially move freely and change direction with stupendous rapidity that made our current capability pale in comparison. How the emitters worked was still in question, but orienting them in various directions was similar to how our spacecraft worked. It wasn't so much that the system defied our understanding of the laws of physics. Its ability to move as quickly and as efficiently as it did was astounding. Essentially, when the propulsion system created that gravity wave or anti-gravity state, everything we knew about how objects could orient themselves in space, about the nature of flight, was altered. It was easy to get hung up on language and whether a gravity wave was being produced or if it was anti-gravity. But essentially, on a fundamental level, what the makers of this craft had done was create a device that could achieve something astounding: gravity control. It reduced or canceled the gravitational field. No one on Earth had been able to do that to that point. It had been speculated about and hypothesized about, but it had not been achieved as we sat there in 1989. Words fail me now, as they did then, to explain how great a paradigm shift in thinking was necessary to truly appreciate what we'd just witnessed. That said, as had been true for most of my adult life, I was able to come up with an analogy to explain in layman's terms how this process worked, or at least to create a visual metaphor to illustrate it. Imagine placing a bowling ball on a level mattress. It would sink into the cushion for a bit before settling and becoming still. If left undisturbed, the bowling ball would not move. You could push that bowling ball and get it to roll. In a sense, man's early efforts at flight were like that. We used a propeller to push air behind the plane to get it moving, used the angle of the wings and their surface area to create lift, and the airplane would leave the ground. With a jet engine or a rocket, we expel hot gases out of the rear of the engine to push the plane forward and create lift. What this alien craft did was like placing your hand on the mattress in any direction around the bowling ball and compressing the cushioned material. The ball would roll in the direction of where the resistance had been removed. A somewhat crude analogy, but sufficient to understand the basics. What the emitters were able to do was to remove the force of gravity, not just in a tight beam, enabling it to move forward, but widening the beam, and having the emitters pivot in various directions was akin to having a group of people standing around that mattress, each of them pressing down on the cushion at various points, allowing the ball to move in multiple directions. Imagine those individuals moving with great speed and force, superhuman speed and force, and the visual becomes even better. I didn't share this analogy with Barry. He showed little interest in my previous motorcycle dropped in among the settlers scenario. What was far less difficult to imagine was how this craft was able to cover vast distances. In a sense, it didn't cover any ground, as we so frequently describe an object moving from one point to another by going over ground from point A to point B. Instead, using that gravity control, this craft pulled distance objects toward it. Imagine a ball resting on a towel with a frisbee at the opposite end of the towel. With the emitters in the frisbee doing their thing, the fabric of the towel was pulled toward the ball that was anchored to it. It was as if the universe was being folded in an accordion-like fashion. As I noted when I first saw the propulsion system functioning, time and gravity are inextricably linked. If you controlled gravity, you also controlled time. That solved the dilemma we currently have with long-distance space travel. How could you possibly supply humans with enough oxygen and food, but even more so, how could you expect them to outlive our usual lifespan in order to travel to distant galaxies? What this propulsion system did was render moot all those kinds of questions. Normally, Barry would quickly shut down any kind of speculative questions about the origins of the device we were working on. He was far more disciplined in his thinking and with his emotions than I was. Following that demonstration, though, even Barry's mind was spinning. "You know, I'm not sure if what they told us is true, but after seeing this, it opens up a whole universe of other possible explanations. I mean, I was sitting here thinking that this thing could have come from another dimension. It could have come from some point in the future. We just don't know." The whole Zeta Reticuli story could be a cover-up. "I just don't think we've got the advanced technology to produce this ourselves in this time. Not even with the assistance of the Russians or teams of scientists from everywhere." "I agree. But you know, Barry, like you always say, if we keep thinking about that part of it, we'll go crazy." Barry laughed. "You're right. Kind of fun to think about, but we aren't here to have fun." Frustratingly, as Barry and I talked about this gravity control device, we kept coming back to the same question over and over again. How was it able to produce such an enormous amount of power from such a simple system without the production of any kind of heat and sound and other indicators of the prodigious amount of energy being used to overcome what we on Earth consider to be one of, if not the most fundamental forces in the universe, gravity? How could something seemingly so simple and fueled by such a simple and small object as the disks do that kind of work? In a way, I wondered if perhaps it functioned on the principles of some martial arts, using your opponent's energy against them, in opposition to them. Ultimately, as our discussion wound down, and the frustration of feeling as if we'd returned to square one and were no closer than ever to being able to reverse engineer the system, it felt pointless to construct ways in which to describe what was going on. I'd heard it said that language allows us to master and take control of our world, to give it shape and meaning. All I could think of as the hours went by and the lights above us hummed nearly as loudly as the craft had was that a mechanical pencil produced a point far less sharp than a pencil sharpened mechanically. At that point, I wondered if maybe I was losing my sanity as more and more divergent and unproductive thoughts passed through my mind. After all, Einstein said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. I was more than a little relieved to go home that night. I was tenacious when faced with a problem that needed to be solved, but now I was frustrated and intrigued, and the push-pull of those two competing forces would ultimately be won by another force, one that was far beyond my control. Chapter 7. Added into the mix of all the questions I had regarding my situation came another and more frustrating question. Why was it that after granting me access to the craft and allowing me to view a test flight, did the voice of the EG&G representative suddenly fall silent? I'd experienced one fallow period in my time with EG&G and been rewarded with those two opportunities. Maybe, I tried to console myself as week one of no calls turned into week two, I'd be similarly rewarded again. What form that reward might take occupied some of my time when I wasn't working, but not nearly enough. Tracy seemed very occupied with the business, her flying lessons, and her social life. She sensed that something was not right in my world, but when she asked me what was wrong, I told her that I was fine, that nothing was in any way out of sorts with me. The devil's bargain that I signed in agreeing to a confidentiality clause required that I not divulge anything, good or bad, a potential state secret, or a simmering dissatisfaction with a coworker, the quality of the food in the cafeteria, the frustrations with having to respond on a moment's notice, the havoc the irregular schedule played with my sleep, were all equally off limits. I'd put up with the unannounced visits to my home, agreed to have my privacy violated by allowing our phones to be tapped, and wasn't even raising a fuss about the fact that I'd yet to receive a paycheck. All I wanted to do was work and to contribute to solving this problem, and I was being subjected to what I thought was a kind of tantalizing treatment. They'd teased me with privileged glimpses, then back away again. Also, for as much as I'd witnessed and believed, and now believed to a greater degree the truth of what I'd read in the briefings and later seen with my own eyes, there was still the possibility that I was somehow being set for a fall. What the nature of that fall was and why I'd been chosen wasn't clear, but I wasn't willing to dismiss anything as a possibility. After all, if my mind had been blown away and my perceptions opened by what I'd seen and learned while working at S4, then I would be foolish to believe that only the most righteous and above board and honest dealings with the employees at S4 were being conducted. Put another way, when your belief system in one part of your life is rocked, that aliens existed in theory but not in actual fact, and now knowing that visitors from outer space had been on our planet, that seismic upset reverberates in other parts of your life as well. Maybe if I had someone with whom I could share what I'd experienced, another perspective to help me sort through all of this upheaval, then maybe I could have found a better way to respond to what happened to me as the Ides of March passed, and I grew more and more anxious and uncertain about my future. Even now, many, many years after those events in the early part of 1989, do I still wonder many of the things I wondered back then. Hindsight generally affords us an opportunity to see things with greater clarity. Growing older and having more experiences can make us wiser, but I still have trouble establishing a firm footing about whether or not the path I chose to take was reckless, wrong-headed, self-sabotaging, or right. Perhaps it was all of those in some combination. As a scientist, I was trained to look for and to find truths. But we all know that even in the scientific community and the undertakings made under that umbrella, there is much that appears initially to be black and white and absolute, but later is revealed to be more gray than white or black. I write this as a way to preface what was to prove to be the unraveling of my life. I paid a heavy price, as did others, and I take full responsibility for my actions and regret deeply those who suffered collateral damage as a result of them. I won't go into much detail about the civilians who were affected. To do so would only open old wounds and expose people I care about to additional discomfort. In some ways, I wish that I had taken this notion of collateral damage into fuller account during those weeks in March of 1989 when I grew increasingly impatient and resorted to self-preservation as one of the central movers in my decision-making. Generally, I'm not a very paranoid individual. I never had a reason to be. But after learning what I had and seeing those demonstrations and crawling around inside that craft, and then not being called in for a week or so, just at the time when we seemed to be making progress and I was being given very exclusive access, I started to really wonder what the hell was going on. After all this transpired, someone told me that the writer William S. Burroughs once wrote, "Sometimes paranoia is just having all the facts." I wasn't aware of that quote back in 1989, but I had some thoughts along that line. To contribute to my growing uneasiness, the house continued to be under surveillance. I did the best I could to ignore it, and I definitely didn't look at it as the positive sign I once had. I suppose that back when Mike Thigpen interrupted the meeting I was having with Wayne and his wife, when our deal for the photo business was still pending, I probably was engaged in a form of wishful thinking. Their search of the premises was very odd, mostly because, as far as I knew, and Tracy had pointed this out, no one that we knew ever commented on the fact that they had been contacted by any agency. Not anyone in my family, no friends, no former employers or colleagues. No one let me know that they'd been questioned about me. That was very odd. A few days after witnessing the low-performance test, I was at home getting ready to go out on a delivery run. I stood at the kitchen sink, rinsing my coffee cup, and saw either a Buick Skyhawk or a Chevy Nova sitting across the street from our house. Whatever the make and model, it was one of those nondescript, bland kinds of cars that I seldom saw in our neighborhood. Inside the car sat two men in dark suits. They were looking straight ahead. I didn't see them using binoculars or a camera with a long telephoto lens, but I was pretty sure they were there watching our house. That suspicion was confirmed when I exited the house and then drove off to drop photos by at Jean's office. The car pulled out behind me, and unlike in thrillers or police procedurals, they made no effort to disguise the fact that they were following me. They didn't keep more than a car length or two behind me, accelerated to keep my pace, and went through a yellow light I purposely slowed down for and then sped through. When I got to Jean's office, the car parked a few spaces away. I was thrown off balance by it all, but managed to pull myself together and didn't let on to Jean that anything out of the ordinary was going on. Jean and I transacted our business, and I went on with the rest of my day. I had to make a stop at Home Depot to get some supplies for a repair project on a leaky showerhead, and the mystery car was there again, trailing behind me. Like the car, the two men were bland and relatively nondescript. Caucasian, mid to late 30s or early 40s, dark suits, white shirts, and sunglasses doing battle with the morning's low sun. I almost had to laugh when I thought of recounting that description to anyone, like I was some hard-boiled detective in a noir detective film. It wasn't so funny when they followed me home and then remained there until another car and two men came to relieve them, early in the evening. When they were still there in the morning, I decided to call the police. I recounted to them what I presented earlier, including the terse description. The officer who took the information assured me that she would pass it along and to expect someone to come to investigate the situation at some point. It must have been a slow morning in Las Vegas. No more than a half hour later, a squad car approached the vehicle and then parked behind it. A minute or so later, the officer got out of the car and approached the driver's side of the vehicle that had been sitting there. I wasn't able to hear or see much at all, but within minutes, the officer was back in his car and drove off. My watchers remained. While all this was going on, Tracy had come downstairs and was getting ready to leave for work. "What's so interesting out there?" she asked. "Not sure. The police just pulled someone over briefly. Gone now." "Are you turning into one of those kinds of guys?" she said, teasing.
"What do you mean?"
Her eyes revealed her amusement. "Oh, you know, the stay-off-my-lawn kind of cranky guy who watches over everything in the neighborhood." Not wanting to reveal my concern, I played along. "No, not one of those guys. The kind of guy who buys a police scanner and monitors all the activity going on around the city. Your guy is way too low-tech for me." She narrowed her gaze at me, unsure, it seemed, if I was kidding or not. "I'm surprised you haven't figured out how to make one, or maybe that's just one of your projects." She used her fingers to make air quotes around the last word. "An idle mind," I said, reminding her of the famous Ben Franklin quote. Tracy left a few minutes later, and my mind was not idling at all, but racing. What had gone on between the police and the observers? Why hadn't they come to speak with me? I'd given my name and address and phone number to the person on the phone. Was I going to get some kind of response to my complaint? Was I going to be followed the rest of the day, and for how far into the future? What did all of this have to do with what I most recently witnessed at S4, if anything? I decided it was best to just go about my business. I could see how easy it would be to get too worked up about it all. I had planned to meet a friend named Mario at a local gym. He and I were workout partners. Every other evening, usually Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, we met and did some cardio work or some weightlifting. Maybe a workout would help relieve some of the stress and help me put things in a better perspective. I pulled into the parking lot a few minutes after 6 o'clock and waited. I thought about the previous time Mario and I had met there. We exercised and then left. I had walked over to my Datsun 280Z and, while chatting with Mario, pulled out my car keys and went to unlock the door. I inserted it, but noticed that the door was already unlocked. "That's weird," I said. "Yeah, it is, but in Japan..." I cut Mario's explanation of sushi off. He'd been telling me about the new restaurant he'd just gone to.
"No, my car. The doors are unlocked. I never do that."
"No, you don't. That's your baby. You treat her right." At the time, I attributed it to just being tired. That night, Mario was running a bit late. I got out of the car after Mario had walked up to mine. I got out, locked the doors, and then lifted the handle. "They're locked, right?"
"Far as I can tell," Mario said.
We both wanted to be home a bit early, so we cut the workout short. About 45 minutes later, we walked out of the gym. I took a few steps into the parking lot and then stopped in my tracks. I looked across the way, and there was my car with both its doors wide open, looking like a fixed-wing aircraft.
"Holy shit," Mario said. "What in the hell? You got broken into."
I stood there frozen in place, my mind ratcheting through several possibilities. It could have been a car burglary. The Z had a decent stereo in it. I had left my wallet and the Uzi I was carrying around for protection inside it. It seemed strange to me that a thief would leave the doors open. Why leave a, "Hey, look what I've done," calling card? Had they been interrupted in the middle of the job? None of that made sense. I'd confided in Mario about my work situation, and I think that though it took him a bit longer than it did me for it to sink in, he got it.
"I don't know if we should walk over there. Who knows?"
He let the thought drift on the night wind. The car did have central locking, but a malfunction of that system wouldn't have allowed the doors to open and the hatch to rise. Somebody had to open those doors, and I had a strong suspicion the men who had been following me were sending a message. "We're still here." I can't say that my blood ran cold or a shiver ran down my spine, but I did experience that gut-level twinge and burn of adrenaline kicking in. I had to fight the urge to jump in the car and take off after them, let them know what it was like to be pursued and followed. I knew it wasn't a good idea to inflame the situation. Look at what happened when I called the police. Mario and I both jumped a bit when the doors behind us opened and rattled. A couple of other gym members walked past us.
"I guess I need to go over there," I said.
"Yeah, you do."
We walked over to the car, and I kept telling myself that I had nothing to worry about. I was definitely spooked, and I could tell that Mario was as well. "If you don't mind," I said, "I'd like your help."
"With what?"
"We're going to have to start the car. That's your job. I'm going inside." We both laughed. They'd sent a clear message, a sign of the kind of power and control they held over me. They didn't like being messed with.
I didn't like being messed with either.
I decided the best course of action was to try to de-escalate the situation. I needed to get better control of my state of mind as well. After all, I had no confirmation yet that I was no longer going to be working at S4 or anything like that. I had Dennis's phone number, so I decided the right course of action was to go to the source and not let my mind run away with me. After all, I also told myself, nothing had gone missing from the car. I got someone in Dennis's office and explained that I wanted to speak with him. After being told that wasn't possible at the moment, and getting a vague to no response at all to my follow-up questions about when he might be available, I left a message indicating who I was and that I very much would like to speak with him at his earliest possible convenience. On and off for the next few days, I noticed that the car would be outside our home, but the following stopped, and nothing bizarre happened while I was out and working on the last few of the photo jobs I was taking on. When 48 hours passed, and I didn't hear back from Dennis or anyone at the number he'd given me, I made another inquiry and left another message. When the tailing resumed and my calls still went unanswered, I started to worry even more, and not just about whether or not I would continue to work for EG&G at S4, but about my own safety and Tracy's and other people I knew. I didn't believe then, and don't believe now, that my fears were the product of an irrational response to stress. Was I stressed? Certainly. Greatly. Undeniably. Was it plausible to believe that because of what I knew and what I had seen that some harm could come to me? Yes, definitely. For as much as I tried to focus just on the task at hand, the implications of what I'd experienced and knew had tremendous consequences. They wouldn't have been going to the length they were to do background checks on me, and they wouldn't have required me to consent to my phones being tapped, and they wouldn't have asked me to sign a document that essentially stated that I agreed to waive every one of my constitutional rights, which I did sign, if there wasn't a serious need for them to keep this information in-house by whatever means necessary. That may seem like a large leap in logic, but given all that I've described about the need for me to carry a weapon, the heightened drama with the surveillance teams, I figured that I had to do something to protect my best interests. No one else was going to do that, so it was incumbent on me to think ahead and consider wisely what I should do to protect my professional reputation, my chances of getting gainful employment elsewhere, and the physical safety of me and others. Only later, after I made the decision to share what I knew with a select few friends, and later more widely, did I think more about the public's right to know this kind of information. I never set out to be a crusader. And though some called me a whistleblower, I blew the whistle initially almost exclusively as an act of self-preservation, whistling to call attention to me to make it less likely that harm would come to me if I made clear what I knew than it was to draw attention to the program at S4 and reveal the nation's deepest and darkest secrets. All of those thoughts got generated in my head, were amplified, and were only emitted when I felt pressed into a corner and had to do so. I knew that Gene was the first person that I should tell. He was my closest friend at the time, and he was about as level-headed a person that I knew. I felt that he'd believe me, and because he didn't have as much at stake personally as Tracy did, he'd be better equipped to give me some guidance about how I should proceed. I had a few vague thoughts in mind. I was confident that everyone who knew me would believe me, but still thinking about the possibility that I might wind up somewhere in the Nevada desert with a bullet in my head and a fabricated suicide note left at home, I was leaning towards showing them evidence to prove the existence of those craft. Sitting in Gene's car as we drove along Alta Avenue was both comfortably familiar and surreal. I prefaced my story with the kind of disclaimer you might expect. This is going to sound really strange, but... When I was done, Gene said that coming from anyone else but me, he'd be incredibly suspicious. Then he added, I knew that something was up when you told me about the gun registration and mentioned something about work. I couldn't have imagined that it was something like this. But hell, who knows what kinds of things go on out there? I figured the UFO stuff was just a bunch of wahoos with nothing better to do with their time. I didn't mention to Gene anything that I'd read in the briefings. For this first time speaking with someone openly about what I was doing, I wanted to stick to what I could definitively validate, what I'd seen, what I'd done, what had been done to me. As tempting as it was to go beyond those three categories of events, I refrained from doing so. As I pointed out before, Gene was an immensely curious man with wide interests, and his curiosity was reflected in the half-dazed, half-enthralled look that spread his face. Just so you're aware, Bob, I'm going to do a little digging around on the subject.
Not to undermine you or anything, just because you've got me thinking. Gene, you're a free man in a free country, and I would never think of telling you what to do or how to go about it. Thanks for listening to me.
No worries. Tracy know?
I haven't told her yet. Obviously, I want to keep as tight of control of all this as I can. At this point, I don't see the sense of pissing anybody off.
You think you might have already?
I can't imagine how. Like I said, they let me on the craft. They let me see it low fly. And now nothing and some harassment. This is all just so nonsensical. Gene nodded.
Hard to figure. Sometimes an irrational response is the only one you can make to another irrational act. But I don't think that's wise here.
Agreed. I'm sure I'll need to talk to you about this again. I hope not, but even if I did get called back in, I'm not sure how I'd respond.
That's understandable. I just don't know if it's all worth it.
I produced from my pocket an envelope that contained the first and what would prove to be the only check I ever received. I slid it over to Gene.
$958.11, he said. That's what the United States Department of Naval Intelligence pays a senior physicist?
That's right. You do it for the love of it, and not to get rich. And to be honest, Gene, this isn't so much about the money as it is the headaches. If I'm getting this kind of runaround and treated like this, the dollars-to-headache ratio is way out of balance. Gene and I talked for a few more minutes, and then he dropped me off at home. When Tracy got back from work, I inadvertently used the words that anyone in a relationship shouldn't use as a point of entry. We need to talk. By the time I made it clear what the subject was, all the tension left her body. She sat on the couch, drew her legs up, and heaved a big sigh while looking at the ceiling.
This isn't some kind of goof, is it? You're serious. I can always tell when you're trying to get me.
No goof. No getting you.
Holy shit, she said,
drawing out the holy for a few seconds.
This is nuts.
Essentially, yes.
I can't see you making up something like this.
She drew a strand of her hair to her mouth and chewed on it, a habit she had when she was nervous. I hadn't told her everything about me being followed and the incident at the gym parking lot, hoping to spare her some worry. Later on, I'd come back to this moment and see it in a different light. Of the three people I spoke to about my concerns, John Lear was the most receptive. That made sense, given what he believed to be true about UFOs back at that time. I'd later come to learn more about the extent and the extremity of John's controversial views. But in those first few minutes, he, like Gene, seemed more curious than alarmed.
Look,
he said, rubbing the stubble on his chin and neck.
We all know that something's out there.
In the desert? John winked at me and said, looking from side to side as he did so,
Yeah, in the desert.
He raised his eyes toward the ceiling, indicating that it wasn't really just the desert he was talking about. I looked around John's home office. The bookshelves were lined with various volumes of different types and sizes. In the corner, a telescope rested on its tripod and leaned against the wall. Along one wall were a series of framed certificates and awards John had received for his exploits as a pilot. Among them, some commemorated world records he had set. John was an accomplished pilot, more than an accomplished pilot, actually. He was fearless and also a bit reckless. Of course, once I got to know John, he shared with me the story of how he injured his feet and legs to such a degree that at times he hobbled around his home in Las Vegas. His father had created a manufactured updated version of a Lear jet. Over time, the model designation has escaped my memory. John was assigned a simple task. Do a flight demonstration for some clients considering acquiring the jet for their use. What John heard and what he listened to were very different things.
Instead of an easy, conventional demonstration of a takeoff and landing and flight, John asked himself, since this was the latest and most improved version of the jet, and highly capable, why not show just how capable it was? He decided to do an outside loop, a very, very challenging and risky acrobatic maneuver. As John told me, once you committed to the move, you couldn't back out. Well, John committed, didn't back out, even when he knew that he was in trouble, and plowed the jet into the ground, sustaining multiple leg injuries, among others. John wasn't someone who was going to play by the rules, but I did trust him. In fact, I trusted him enough to take trips with him when he had to ferry commercial jets to one airport or another. He asked me along both for company and to wear a suit so that I could pass as an FAA inspector. Once aloft, John would light up his pipe, later to doze off completely with the autopilot of the L-1011 functioning, and then wake up just in time to land the craft manually. I also trusted him with Tracy's life, and he gave her the first few flying lessons she had. He even allowed her at one point to take the controls of a commercial flight he was piloting. To say John was a loose cannon is an understatement, and in looking back on it now, I can see to what degree how stressed and anxious I was to believe that John was someone who could help me put events into their proper perspective. By that I mean how I should approach the situation vis-a-vis my employment prospects. In terms of having someone who could assess the capabilities of the craft and determine whether they were anything in line with what terrestrial technology could produce, I knew of no one more qualified than he was. There was some risk inherent in sharing this information with John, but I also knew how much he believed in the existence of alien spacecraft and beings. My focus remained purely on the technology, and if John could offer any insight into that, then it was worth the price of having him possibly go off on tangents regarding the beings who produced that craft. I'd be able to tune that out. That's not to say that he wasn't an interesting guy to be around, and he demonstrated his generosity toward me on multiple occasions. Still, John had his own theories about extraterrestrial life and government conspiracies that I can see now, in hindsight, predisposed him to believe what I was telling him. I also want to make it explicitly clear that he never urged me to do anything. He simply accepted an invitation to participate in acts that I instigated. I was grateful that, for a few days at least, things seemed to settle down. No strange incidents occurred, and though the guys on overwatch were still around the house, I wasn't being followed, at least as far as I could tell. I supposed that, in retrospect, I inadvisably let my guard down a bit. One afternoon, 2 days after letting Gene in on my secret, we were at his house. Over lunch, he told me that he'd been searching the internet for information about UFOs. This was still early in the life of the internet, and information was relatively scarce compared to how it has proliferated. He told me a number of things, none of which really jibed with what I had witnessed, and even back then, we realized that you can't believe much of what you read on the internet. We continued chatting, and I asked him about the source of the information he shared with me. There's two places in particular that seem to be gathering points. One is called MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. The other is QFON, the Canadian UFO Network. That's not very Canadian of them, I said. You'd think the kindly Canadians would want to be part of the Mutual Network. We got to laughing and joking a bit more, and it felt great to breathe easy for a bit. Eventually, Gene decided that since I had the real deal in terms of UFO information, I should be referred to as UFON, for the Bob UFO Network. I countered with him transforming himself into Goofon, for obvious reasons. For the rest of the time we spent that afternoon, we continued to call each other by our new noms de UFO. Gene's wife had given birth to a son on March 15th, and Gene was giddy with delight and sleeplessness. It was good to be around someone who was in such good spirits. He was grateful for the break from the routines of a young one and visitors. Somehow, all of this made me think that maybe my world had somehow been righted. That feeling didn't last. I woke up before sunrise to see that the car was stationed in the same place it had been before. I wasn't physically tailed, but it was exhausting to feel as if my every move was being watched over. When I got home later in the day, Tracy was out. I felt like I needed to commiserate with someone. Deciding to not let on how down I was, I called Jean. When the answering machine responded, I said, "Goofon, this is Buffon. I have the baby pictures for you. I know you need them as soon as possible." Jean hadn't given me any photos, and I hoped that he'd pick up on that right away. I sat there hoping he'd call back. In the interim, about 45 minutes later, a car came into our driveway and braked hard. I heard a couple of car doors slam and then a rapid knock at the door. I answered it, and two very official and distressed-looking men in suits escorted me to the kitchen table. There, they began their interrogation. Basically, they wanted to know who this Buffon character was or what it was code for. The same with Goofon. Then, they produced a printed copy of the message that I'd left for Jean not quite an hour earlier. I couldn't believe how quickly they'd gotten it and then gotten to the house. I was tempted to ask them about how they managed that task, but I could see they were in no mood for lightheartedness. I told them that they were just goofy names we'd made up a few weeks ago. We were in a silly mood at the time, and that was it. Nothing sinister at all. That seemed to appease them, but they produced a document that they made me fill out. I had to identify Jean by name, provide them with his mailing address, phone number, and other information that I was sure they already had. I also had to refer to Jean by his last name, Huff, and then add Jean Huff, a.k.a. Goofon. To this day, and even back then, Jean and I still laugh about that incident. Jean will still, on occasion, sign his name and then append it with a.k.a. Goofon. Even though I was amused by that incident, I still felt like lines had been crossed. I'd agreed to the wiretap, but that was to determine my suitability for a security clearance. It no longer seemed certain to me that they would conclude that I was a good candidate to work at S4, so I thought the investigations should cease. I'd also essentially signed away my rights to due process under the law. I'd been trying not to think of that while all of this nonsense was going on, and had never mentioned that fact to Tracy. When I had told Jean about that, he said,
"I'm not surprised you signed that document, but I sure would be worked up about it. You don't respond to things like that the way the rest of us do."
Hearing him say that made me realize even more that I needed to bring this thing to some kind of conclusion. If I wasn't able to keep my wits about me in the way that Jean had indicated I had in the past, it was time to make some changes. In the initial interviews, I'd been asked a lot of questions about how I managed stress, and I'm sure that my phone calls to Dennis's office, I'd made a few more with no success, calling the police, and now playing name games, all contributed to my sense that my days at S4 were over. I can see now that I did those things for another reason. I wanted the wait to end. I just wanted to be told yes or no and move on. I knew that security clearances could take time, but it was the frustrating stop and start of the work, being pressured to figure out the answer, but not being given the proper time needed to solve it, that made me get to the point that I wanted something definitive to be said or done. It may be hard to believe, but coexistent with those feelings was a desire to see the job through. I can't say it was as strong as it had been before, but by still wanting to do the work, and not being able to do the work for no reason anyone could really offer, ratcheted up my anger at being put in that situation. I decided to take action. As I pointed out, I wanted my wife and friends to have eyewitness certainty about the claims that I had made. That meant one thing, getting them out to the area to see a test flight. For years, people in the area had reported strange lights and other activity in the sky. Because of my time in the lab at S4, I knew when one of those displays was going to occur. Wednesdays at 8 in the evening was the usual time a high-performance test flight was going to be conducted. I informed the rest of the others that I thought we should all drive out to the desert to witness one of those tests. John Lear owned a Winnebago motorhome, and he volunteered to drive us all out to the perimeter of the base. In some ways, I thought that maybe including John wasn't the best idea. There was also some odd tension between Gene and him, but I knew that John's expertise and his 8-inch diameter Celestron telescope would be valuable in assessing what we saw during the high-performance test. As a bonus, we could travel in style in his motorhome. It was a 150-mile or so trip through some of the most boring desert landscape you can imagine. We'd be setting out in the late afternoon and getting there after dark when there'd be even less to see. Of the assembled group, Gene and John performed as the two ends of the poles between skepticism and belief. Gene wasn't rabidly anti-UFO belief, but given some of the strangeness between the pair, I figured they'd give each other crap. That would be good for some entertainment. We always seemed to be able to ride John pretty hard when he launched into some out-there discussion about whatever had caught his attention. John was kind of like a magpie. Anything shiny, and he'd take it and fly off with it. Yet, when you asked him a question about his area of expertise, it was like a switch flipped in his brain, and he was the most articulate and focused expert. Sure enough, after John picked up Tracy and me, Tracy liked John since he was the one who really introduced her to the new love of her life, flying, we headed to Gene's house. When Gene came out to the motorhome, I heard John snort. "Where the hell did you get that shirt?" he asked. I hadn't paid much attention to what Gene was wearing, but at John's cutting remark, I saw that it was black and purple and looked like massive bruising had spread across my friend's upper body.
"Your wife got it for me," Gene snapped back.
It wasn't exactly a your mama joke, but close enough. John put the RV in gear, and we headed out from Gene's place. The usual conversations about best routes began. Gene was in favor of taking the interstate until we got to Highway 93 to head north. John had to be contrarian, so after making a few veiled references to President Eisenhower and his real reason for establishing the interstate system in this country, instead of the interstate, he took Powerline Road, until it intersected with the Great Basin Highway.
"How can you be in the middle of nowhere if you're nowhere?" Gene asked as we bounced along the irregular pavement.
"That's for greater minds than yours to determine," John said. "I know this, though. I've flown over a few different nowheres, and I can tell you that the middle looks a lot like the rest of it."
Tracy intervened and asked about Gene's new baby and how he managed to get the night off. His in-laws were still in town, and they looked at him askance when he told them he was going out with friends.
"I heard someone say once that it's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is for permission," John chimed in.
We all laughed at that. The conversation was on anything and everything but what we were all about to do and to see. I suspected that the worst thing that could possibly happen was the test flight to be canceled for some reason. The weather wouldn't be an issue, but I knew that there was nothing I could do to control what the powers that be decided. At one point, the RV began to stagger a bit on a climb.
"Damn it," John said,
and pulled over to the shoulder. Eventually, the problem was diagnosed. The transmission was low on fluid.
"Call yourself a pilot? Have you ever heard of a pre-flight check?"
"And to think I let you take my wife up in a plane."
More good-natured insults and comments were hurled at John. Gene volunteered to hitchhike back to a gas station to get some fluid and then hitch a ride back. When he came back, he had a 6-pack of beer in one hand and 2 quarts of automatic transmission fluid in the other.